WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Nearly 10 years ago, Carla Faye Tucker and her boyfriend, Daniel Ryan Garrett, brutally murdered an acquaintance of theirs, Jerry Lynn Dean. Dean was a local drug dealer in Houston where they all lived. Tucker and Garrett had had some run-ins with him, so they went to his apartment to scare him, to teach him a lesson. Instead, they bludgeoned him and a woman they didn't know to death. Dean's head was nearly severed from his neck from the blows he received. Both victims were struck repeatedly with a pickaxe. Tucker and Garrett drove away from the murder scene in Dean's truck. 5 weeks later, family members turned them in to the police. Both Tucker and Garrett were sentenced to death for their crimes. Tucker is now on death row. Beverly Lowry read about Carla Tucker's trial in her local newspaper and became obsessed with Tucker and her story. 18 months earlier, Lowry's son Peter had been killed by a hit-and-run driver. Lowry's written about her grief over her son's death and her relationship with Tucker in a book called Crossed Over, A Murder, A Memoir. I asked her what the connection was between Carla Tucker and the death of her son.
I never meant for there to be a strict parallel drawn between the deaths of the people Carla murdered, or Peter's death, or Peter's life and Carla's life. There are crossovers, but it is not as though Peter was killed, therefore I went to see this woman. I do think that most people who've had children die suddenly and violently would probably get this pretty quickly. There's a whole atmosphere you live in where you can't get out of the fact of this unthinkable death. And so events, people, subjects appeal to you. I read mystery books for the first time in my life during that time. I read crime after crime book. I read poetry. I could not read novels. I learned to love classical music because it was new. I didn't know classical music until that time. And so that this adventure appealed to me. It was almost the same as if I had decided to climb Mount Everest or something. I was drawn to something beyond where I'd been before.
You write about trying to understand why something happens, and in this case, trying to understand why Carla Faye Tucker ended up in a house, and why a man she knew was murdered in the most grisly kind of way. And you write that events and reasons mesh, briefly make sense, and then they fall away. Did you go into this story thinking that you would come to some piece of truth about why human beings behave the way they do, or misbehave the way they do?
I entertain the thought that I might. Underneath, what I understand is that motivations at bottom and actions have a mysterious core no matter what. I'm a fiction writer, and I don't think a person writes fiction thinking that if I just write this book, then I'll get it. It'll all be squared away, and I don't have to deal with that or think about that anymore. But still in all, I was looking for answers, and I would think I was hoping because, like a lot of people, I entertain childish hopes often.
How difficult was it, or how easy was it for you to begin a relationship with Carla Faye Tucker?
Like falling off a log. I walked in and looked at her. She looked at me, and it was as if we'd seen each other before or had known each other before in a dream or something. And it was, in a way, like falling in love or forming an instant attachment. I knew the minute I saw her that I was in trouble, that I was not going to be able to turn away and walk away from that meeting and say, okay, I did that, now I can go on with my life. I knew I was going to become more attached than probably a lot of people would think was healthy or made sense. There was no sense of objectivity about the beginning or about the writing of the book, except in the editing of the book.
As you got to know her and she did tell you about her life, she began to really have very serious problems. Even by the young age of 8 years old, or even by the age of 10, she was shooting up heroin. By early adolescence, she was having sex. Did anyone notice what was going on with young Carla Faye Tucker?
Mostly the adults she knew were running in the same pack. They were bikers and call girls, and that's what her mother did. And so they were. There was no adult. Her father, I think, tried. And Carla was the youngest. Her older sister had already hit the streets, in effect. And so he tried to corral her, and I think he is a good and decent man. He just was way over his head.
Was there any way in which Carla's childhood was normal, in the way that we think of normal?
Yes, yes. And she, in fact, insists on that understanding of it. This is not a story of somebody who was physically abused. She was very loved as a child, and life started out very normal for a family in Houston of working-class parents and a family who were hoping to climb up out of that status into middle-class status, into a status where the children were more educated than the parents.
Well, her mother died when she was young, and you quote her as saying, "I turned stone cold to the world." Do you see that as a time when Carla Faye Tucker's life changed and changed for the worse?
Without question. The mother was in charge. And even though it seems that Carolyn Moore, Carla Faye's mother, was as the chaplain at the school, at the jail said, face it, Carolyn Moore was a bad mother, and there's no question but what she was a bad influence for Carla because she was turning tricks and doing drugs and all of that. And nonetheless, she was Carla's. She kept a cap on Carla. She's taught her manners and taught her, as Carla said, to clean the house and to clean up after herself. And once she died, Carla was in charge of herself, and she just let loose.
How has prison changed Carla Faye Tucker? And she is on death row in Texas.
Yes, she's on death row with three other women. Prison gave her a chance to become the woman I think she always was, the girl she always was. She became a girl first. When I first met her, she seemed about 12. She was gushy, and she's like an adolescent or even a pre-adolescent. Since then, she's grown up a lot. I think she's probably an adult now. But she had to go through those phases. She did not have a childhood. By the time she was 8, when she started smoking dope, and 10 when she started shooting heroin, she had a complete hysterectomy when she was 15 because she had some problems. And it's not any question in my mind but what she needed help, but she probably decidedly did not need that. And so she was this grown-up child, this child masquerading as a grown-up. So prison gave her an opportunity to have a childhood, to have an adolescence, and become the person she might have become in other circumstances.
Did you ever interview the family of her victims, or the families of her victims?
I have talked to the dead girl's brother extensively, and that was a tragic situation. There was a tragic family. The father was murdered, and Deborah, the dead girl, was killed by Carla. The mother died, and so there's a surviving brother who has asked that Carla's sentence be commuted, and I've talked to him extensively about his feelings, and it took him a while, but he went to see Carla in July and has begun a relationship with her and is in communication with her.
So he actually is getting to know his sister's murderer.
Yes. He has gotten to know her and has asked that her sentence be commuted.
Because?
He thinks she has rehabilitated herself or has come to terms with what she's done and does feel remorse. And he does not believe she should particularly get out right now, but that she should not die. That's all. That's all he's asking for, and that's all I think. It's not as though I think she should be sprung or even understood. I would hope that people would come to understand her, because it's a way of understanding our own hearts, and she is not, to me, she was never a them. It's not she's them and I'm we. She's part of us, and the more we can understand how any of us behaves or comes to do something this horrific, the better off we all are.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first let me reintroduce you. And I'm speaking today on Fresh Air with writer Beverly Lowry. And we're talking about her first book of nonfiction, which is called Crossed Over. And it's about a young woman named Carla Faye Tucker, who was on death row in Texas for a murder that she committed. The book is also about Lowry's own son's death. And he was killed in a hit-and-run accident. Crossed Over is about my guest's attempts to understand why Tucker did what she did and to understand who her troubled son became and why. And we'll talk some more about the son. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking today with Beverly Lowry. As you got to know Carla Faye Tucker, you began to see some similarities between her and your son, Peter. How were they alike?
They were only alike in that they both left the possibility of... They both lived outside conventional expectations of childhood. And in the case of Peter, it was, he left that in a way more clearly than Carla did, because Carla's family life sort of, it wasn't a surprise that she did what she did. In Peter's case, it was a little more inexplicable to me that he would behave the way he did, and he got in trouble with the law. There was nothing to the extent of even close to what Carla did. Nonetheless, any parent whose child has done things to get in trouble with the law, anytime the law is in your life changes, and it is excruciating. And it's something a parent struggles and struggles to understand. And in the end, I think probably rarely does. Peter's death did not have to do with his being in trouble. I mean, they are two separate events, which is something it took me a long time to make my peace with.
What were Peter's problems with the law? What had he done to get in trouble with the law?
He and some kids, two other friends, took a car that they found, a Trans Am with the eagle on the hood and all that. I mean, it was a white Trans Am with the keys left in the trunk. They took it off, and it was essentially what, in my time, would have been, if in a town that I had grown up in, if boys did that, it would have been a joyride.
What was it called
in
your
town?
We
lived in a town where we weren't known, Peter wasn't known, so there wasn't this possibility of going and say, oh, come on, it's just Peter Lowry, you know, let's take care of it. So he was put in jail and spent the night in jail. His friends weren't, because they weren't with him at the time, and he never turned them in. He took the rap. He took the rap several times, which, again, is puzzling. Why was he doing this? And then he stole some other things. He failed in school. And it kept getting a little worse. It kept getting a little worse. And I kept thinking it would stop. And I kept thinking, in effect, that he would get bored with it, because... it's awful. It was awful for him, and because he didn't seem to be getting bored with it, I didn't know how far it would go.
You write, you get so used to scaling down, and I assume what you're saying is that as a parent, you have certain expectations about what this child is going to turn out to be, and then as events happen, that picture shrinks and changes and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. Is that what you were dealing with as a parent?
Absolutely. I mean, one time you're thinking college, or you know, what are his talents and what are his possibilities? And then he fails a grade and then fails another grade. And then you think, well, okay, maybe not college, but maybe this. And then he's spending the night in jail. And so you keep gearing down. And then finally, and you're thinking, and this is what I've thought with a nephew of mine and other the sons in particular, but sons and daughters of friends of mine, just hope they live. Just hope if they can live through this, then maybe they'll find themselves and have a happy or contented or satisfying adulthood. And I thought that if he just made it through a couple of years, that he'd probably get his feet under him. And he didn't.
You wrote something that really stopped me in my tracks. And you wrote, "To this day, I have no idea what I did for my two boys that was constructive and useful and right and good, and what damaged them. None." Do you still believe that? You have no idea?
I'm afraid it's true. I mean, if I sat down with a family therapist or some, and I've taken myself, this book has helped me let myself off the hook to some extent, because in a way it's an extraordinary vanity to think I did it all and I made him, because then what he is or what he was, because then that would mean if he or my other son had some great accomplishment that I would take responsibility for that as well. And it's just not true. But what I was trying to say was how mysterious it all is and how little we do know, and how it seemed to me that what we were trying to do was be different parents to our children than our own parents were to us, my husband and I. And it backfired. It seemed to me that exactly what I thought the good things were, the good things I could bring to this job of parenting, were the very things that Peter in particular did not need. He needed a lot more structure, I believe. And I thought that this kind of openness that I thought was the new and good way to parent would be the thing that would allow him to open up his life and become whatever it is he needed or wanted to be without somebody telling him what that should be.
You mentioned earlier that in your own mind until recently that you saw your troubled son Peter's troubled life as being very connected to his death, but you don't think that way now. How was he killed?
He was the one part of the hit and run that has to do with his life or the trouble he'd been in was because he was in that place at that time he was hit, and it was very late. He was supposed to have been home at 11, and he stayed in town with his friends late, and it was close to, I expect, 2 a.m. by the time he started home. His car blew a tire. It was wet. When something like this happens, it's as if the fates had everything set up for it to happen. The summer had been extraordinarily dry. That day, it was Labor Day, the drought broke. It rained, and the road was slick. He blew a tire and went off into the muddy shoulder, was not able to get the jack to seat properly, and so he walked home. It was about 2 miles to where we lived, and he had walked within an eighth of a mile of where our driveway is when something hit him. A truck. It was something big because it hit him high, just under the ribs, and he wasn't damaged in the lower part of his body at all. But we don't know what. We don't know if it was a truck or something off the side of a truck. And he went down and hit his head on the back, so he went that way. And whatever it was that hit him went on. Whether or not that driver knew he or she hit him or not, we don't know. It's a mystery. And that was the hard part to swallow, was that I would never know that it was a mystery, and it would remain a mystery.
What was your state of mind then after your son had died and you began to see these stories about Carla Faye Tucker and the murder that she had been involved in?
It was 18 months later when I saw that first story, and I was still, and 18 months is not very long. I was in a very emotional state, shaky emotional state at that point. And I was in therapy, and I had just finished one novel and was trying to finish another. Both books had been written before his death. I had drafts of both books, and so I wasn't really writing very well. I was rewriting, And so when I saw the picture, I felt a sense of hope about her, about making a contact with her. And it was the first spark of hope and passion that I had felt since his death. And so it was a lot of the reason for going to see her was for myself. I thought I might find that spark of hope and that look of serenity that she had within myself. If she could find it, then perhaps I could find it.
What did getting to know Carla Faye Tucker do for you, and even what has it done for you?
While I was, when I first started going to see her, it gave me hope. It gave me something to look forward to. I always look forward to going to see her. I look forward to hearing from her. It was not exactly like having a child. It was more like having a grandchild in the way people respond to their grandchildren, because I could, in a way, do better by her than I felt I had done before. And a lot of this is a self-indulgent guilt, I have to tell you. But nonetheless, the worst thing that can happen to a child had happened to mine. And this was a way of doing something for somebody and, in the end, getting an enormous amount back. That wasn't why I did it, but boy, it happened. I mean, she gave me a lot. And so I always look forward to going to see her, and it sparked my life. As far as having written the book, it has done what I set out to do, which was to tell the story of two women who, in extreme circumstances, who found a way to make a friendship and to support one another and give one another a sense of life that they perhaps had not had before. The most satisfying thing to me is that a lot of people have gotten that. I didn't know when I was writing it if the connection would make sense to people. And some haven't. Some have said, I don't get it. I mean, what does this have to do with that? But mostly people have, and that's the most satisfying part.
Beverly Lowry, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Beverly Lowry's book is called Crossed Over, A Murder, A Memoir. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.